This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us as we discuss the important events of the week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
Anyone in Cuba younger than about 60 years old has never experienced life in a country not led by Fidel Castro, or more recently, his brother Raul Castro. But this last Wednesday, Cuba got a new president. What might this mean for the people of Cuba? For this, we'll turn to Andrew.
Yes, starting Wednesday and going into Thursday, Cuba's National Assembly met to elect a new president. The vote was unanimous. All 605 members of the National Assembly voted for the only person running for the position, Miguel Díaz-Canel. This is a man who was the Minister of Higher Education, was being groomed by Raul Castro for the past 5 years or so to become the next president. He was, like I said, introduced to the assembly this Wednesday. They had a only option, and Castro was in the room, so definitely got unanimous support. He will now be taking up a position as the president, though Castro will keep his position as the chairman of the Communist Party of Cuba. And like you said, this is the first person in 60 years to be president of Cuba who's not named Castro. He was actually born, I think, the day after Fidel Castro took power, or shortly thereafter Fidel Castro took power, at least. So also the first member of the first president of communist Cuba who never experienced life before the revolution.
So this is in the midst of what this renaissance that's happened between American relations and Cuban relations that Barack Obama initiated. There may be some people who are looking at this as the possibility of some kind of a rejuvenation in the Cuban economy and for life for Cubans. Is that a realistic view?
I definitely think there are some that are hopeful that this is going to be a new era for Cuba. And in a lot of those ways, those hopes are probably misplaced. Like I said, Canel Diaz was hand-groomed by Raul Castro, staunch party loyalist. It doesn't look like there's going to be a huge break in policy. He's going to kind of continue on the path Raul Castro was already on. Now, that path will likely include some economic reforms. Back in 2011, Raul Castro, he's trying to get more investment into the island, so he's tried to decentralize the economy a little bit, allow some entrepreneurial activity, allow some private sector growth, just because, well, historically speaking, Marxism normally has about a 70-year shelf life, and Cuba's 60 years into it. So it's kind of to the point where it collapses like the Soviet Union collapses, or it goes through an economic opening similar to China did in the 1980s. And so that's kind of what Raul Castro was hoping to do with a little bit of this economic opening. And a lot of economic analysts are saying that Canel Diaz is going to have to do something similar if he wants to, I guess, protect his dictatorship from just collapsing under its own weight.
So looking at Cuba in light of what the Trumpet has been saying about this, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has drawn a lot of attention to Cuba's strategic importance, and looking at the history of this island nation, just how much the enemies of America have viewed it as a possible stepping stone to being able to attack the United States. What's your view of how this might affect the way that, say, those who would want to strike against the United States would view Cuba?
Well, Cuba is, as you say, very strategically located. The U.S. has their base in Guantanamo Bay there because it's at the entrance of the Caribbean Sea. That's very strategic for protecting the Panama Canal. Back even when the Holy Roman Empire was active under Charles V, Cuba was a major trade port between Europe and Latin America. More recently, with like Cuban Missile Crisis, the Soviets were trying to put nuclear bombs in Cuba because it's actually close enough to the United States, only 90 miles away, that you can actually launch a nuclear missile from there without it having to get high enough into the atmosphere to be detected by a lot of our anti-missile technology, which does make it very, like I said, a strategic vulnerability for the United States if a foreign power gets a foothold there. There have been a number that have tried. Like I said, more in the Cold War, Russia was very active there. More recently, Cuba's been very close with Iran and Hezbollah and Venezuela, and even involved in some illegal activities, getting passports for Hezbollah agents so that they can sneak into Latin America via Venezuela and help drug cartels move stuff into the United States. That's why it was so controversial when President Obama lifted the sanctions on Cuba, and Mr. Mm-hmm. Flurry talks about that a lot in that article you mentioned, that he lifted these sanctions, tried to open up flights between the U.S. and Cuba, full knowing that they have been involved with helping Islamic terrorists give logistic support to drug cartels. Now, President Trump has scaled back on some of that opening, even having closing down their embassy in Cuba recently. But other powers are definitely not scaling back. I saw that the European Union, after President Obama lifted the sanctions on Cuba, they also lifted their some of their trade restrictions, and they've really been trying to move in to get investment in the island. I even have one of the EU's top diplomats, Federica Mogherini, was there on January 3rd and mentioned to Castro that she said, regardless of the changes in policy in Washington, the message I bring here is that friendship and relationships with the EU is here to stay. It's solid, it's stable, it's reliable. So as a Canal Diaz is looking at possibly opening up parts of the economy to kind of keep his his dictatorship afloat, the European Union's very eager to engage in Cuba, engage in trade, engage in investment, even as the United States, for a very understandable reason, is less eager because of the terrorist threat.
Mm-hmm.
But when you read that in the context of the article Mr. Flurry had written, that you know that there's a long history between Europe going all the way back to the Holy Roman Empire, using Cuba as like a foothold or a stepping stone to project power into North America and Latin America. And so if you've got that close alliance between the European Union and Cuba, it becomes strategically possible to use it that way again.
We'll certainly have to keep our eyes on it, and it is worth going back to that March 2015 Trumpet print edition article from Gerald Flurry called The Deadly Dangerous U.S.-Cuba Deal. He talks about just how involved the Pope was in paving the way for this rapprochement between President Obama's administration and the Cuban regime, and why Europe has such a vested interest in that area, particularly in light of biblical prophecies of the United States suffering a besiegement at the hands of a force that includes the European Union. Whether or not this change in presidency facilitates that or pushes moves that plan forward definitely is something that we need to be watching. I think just being reminded of what Gerald Flurry wrote about that puts this on a little bit different level than maybe just looking at it as, you know, the change of name, but not really in policy in that country. And as you said, even some of those economic changes that Raul Castro made have maybe opened the door for the fulfillment of that prophecy in some way. Well, we do really appreciate that, Andrew. Despite having a virtually unchecked power, the strongman of Turkey made a move to increase his control over his country even further. For this story, we'll now turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Our listeners will remember that a few months ago, Turkey had a referendum, and that it narrowly passed this referendum that would change the system inside the government system inside Turkey to a president-based system. They would lose the office of prime minister, more powers would be given to the executive, and that just passed. We saw this as a way that the current president Recep Tayyip Erdogan would maintain power inside Turkey for another potential 12 years. Those new laws were going to come into effect January 24th, and yet the office for president, or the election for that office, was going to take place in another 18 or 19 months. Well, Recep Tayyip Erdogan has decided that he cannot wait for that election, and he's brought forward the election 17 months ahead of schedule, and now at the end of June, we are going to have the elections inside Turkey for that extremely high office.
What was his explanation of why it needed to be moved forward? You said he couldn't wait for what?
For more power, for the opportunity to wield the power of the president, this new executive way of ruling that Turkey is going to have underneath this new government once it comes in, this new style of government. He said this, I'll just quote him, "We have decided that elections should be held on June 24th, 2018. Our preference has been to try and hold out till the date in November 2019. However, whether it be the cross-border operation in Syria or the historic developments in Iraq and Syria, or the historic developments in Iraq and Syria have made it so that it is paramount for Turkey to overcome uncertainty." And so he is seeing the situation, the geopolitical scene, and he notices that we need a strong leader right now. We can't wait for another 2 years to enact those policies that we already voted on. Let's do it right now on June 24th, and let's have that presidential election at exactly the same time.
What has the response been to this move? It seems like it's in keeping with a lot of what he has been doing ever since, particularly since that coup. Was that last summer or the summer before? How much of a surprise did this come to people?
It was slightly surprising, just because he had been firm that he wanted to wait till 2019 for this election. But there are a number of reasons of why he might wanted to move it earlier. One, he is experiencing a lot of popularity right now among the Turks, just because of the successful mission inside northern Syria to support the rebels and make sure the Kurds don't grow in power just below their border. And so he's riding a wave of nationalist sentiment. So he figures, if I have an election now, I could be a shoo-in for this presidential office. If I wait a year and a half, I might not be so popular by that point. There's also got Turkey's economic situation right now, which is favorable right now, and yet there is a lot of economists that are saying in another 6 months, Turkey, because of rising inflation and foreign investment that's leaving from Turkey, Erdogan's government or the government of Turkey is going to be in a bad way. And so if you've got disgruntled voters, they might not vote for the incumbent. And so he sees this as pretty much everyone does when they call early elections. This doesn't happen in the United States, but can happen most other places in the world, that those in the government can call early elections whenever they deem, within a certain window, whenever they want to. And he says right now, well, let's have an election now, because this is my greatest chance to hold on to power. And if he wins the election, which it looks like he will, we could see this man ruling for another decade inside Turkey.
Now, there are some analysts who are looking at this and saying this is pretty much the final nail in the coffin for Turkey in terms of having any semblance of democratic representation, that this would really mark a new Turkey. How do you view this as far as how much this would actually change this nation?
Yeah, it's going to change Turkey as much Ataturk did when he came to power 80 years ago plus. I mean, we have one analyst I'd quote. He's the director of the Turkish program at the Washington Institute, and he wrote a biography on Erdogan. He said this: "I think June 24th is going to be a historic day in Turkey. It is when the office of prime minister will cease to exist, when the president will be able to rule by decree, and the executive presidency will fully form. We'll be switching from one Turkey to another. It will be a dramatic day." And so you might just look at this as being, oh, so he's just calling early elections. Well, no, the whole style of government is going to be changing on that day as well inside Turkey, which the whole reason they had the referendum was, we're in uncertain times. The executive branch needs more power to enact laws. Underneath these new, the referendum, what they voted on is going to give, it's going to get rid of the prime minister's office. He's going to have the opportunity to install vice presidents that are unelected, that don't answer to the people at all. He's also going to have a greater say in appointing judges to the highest judicial boards in the country, so like the Supreme Court, as well as issue decrees that have the force of law. And so this, if he wins June 24th, and he wouldn't have called an early election if he didn't think he was going to win, we are going to see Erdogan have dictatorial powers inside Turkey for the next decade.
What is the prophetic significance of that, Brent? Why would we be concerned about it just from the standpoint of what we're looking for in Turkey in the time ahead?
Well, I mean, Bible prophecy doesn't say whether Erdogan will continue to rule Turkey or not, but it does indicate that there is going to be a strong ruler of that country that is able to navigate a lot of these alliances that the Bible talks about, especially an alliance with Europe. It also talks about in the Bible that Turkey is going to be part of one of the greatest double crosses in history against Israel, and we have seen that Erdogan has those tendencies for sure, definitely a fair weather friend for Israel. So he seems to fit the bill of the Turkish leader for the future. And empowering him from here on out certainly looks to fulfill those prophecies.
If someone wants more information, where would you send them?
I would read actually an article you wrote back in 2007. It's called Why Turkey Matters. It talks about in great detail just the relationship Turkey's going to have with Israel, with Europe, what the Bible says about their future, and how Erdogan really could lead Turkey through all this.
All right. Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Last week, France, the U.S., and the United Kingdom united in striking Syria after a chemical weapons attack. One prominent voice in Germany was unhappy that his nation didn't participate. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yeah, so this one voice has triggered a lot of discussion within Germany about their role in the world, their military role in the Middle East, and that one voice was the former German defense minister, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. So German Chancellor Angela Merkel did not go along with the bombing. She did come out and say that she supports the bombing, that she's glad that these other nations bombed Syria, but that Germany wouldn't be doing anything. And this was kind of a typical Merkelism of steering the narrow path that's kind of between all the different opposing points of view. It seems broadly popular. About 60% of Germans say that they think that the strike on Syria over the weekend was a mistake. But Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg really came out very forcibly about what she'd said. He said we support the strikes, but we're not doing that ourselves, isn't that just having other people do our dirty work for us? He said that, when people are slaughtered, you also have to intervene. And he was making a very strong case for getting involved there. And I think it's fascinating to see zu Guttenberg do this. If you go back to 2009, Germany had been involved in Afghanistan for years, but they talked about it as an engagement or as combat operations. Nobody would use that three-letter word, war. And zu Guttenberg was the first person who called it what it is, who said, we're engaged in a war in Afghanistan. And that was a big deal for Germany to actually admit, oh, we're fighting a war thousands of, or at least hundreds of miles from our borders in the Middle East. And that generated a huge amount of talk. He was also responsible for restructuring the German army. Before, it was a conscription force designed to throw up as many men as possible in case Russia invaded the German homeland. He took that and changed it into this volunteer force, the idea that it would be leaner and meaner, you know, more professional, better trained, and much more focused on intervening abroad rather than just throwing up cannon fodder for the Russians at home. So he's got this long history of steering Germany to take, say, a more warlike posture, or at least changing the role that the military plays in Germany. And that ending of conscription had huge knock-on effects that we're still feeling today, because a conscription army doesn't need to volunteer. It doesn't need recruiters. You know, now you've got the German army, and Mr. McDonald talked about this at a trumpet brief a few weeks back, you know, having to try and generate viral videos on YouTube, going into schools and extolling the benefits of the military in a way that Germany hasn't had to do for decades. So he's been behind this for a long time. And you're seeing this continue now with what he's saying in Syria. And it fits into that pattern. And it's exactly that pattern that is the reason we've been drawing attention to Zu Gutenberg. We was first writing on him about a decade ago. And there's really important prophecies in the Bible about a strong leader in Germany. And around 10 years ago, trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury was saying, well, we think Zu Gutenberg may well be this man. He may be this strong leader. There's a lot of evidence to suggest he's going to be this strong leader. And the Bible says that this strong leader is going to take Germany in a warlike direction. And what do you see 10 years down from the line from that is that Zu Gutenberg, he's been out of office. He's now starting to take on a more high-profile role in elections, still not in office, but he's still pushing Germany in that more warlike direction. Now, in terms of what he says in the interview, I think a lot of his criticism makes sense. I mean, there is a certain hypocrisy in saying we support bombing Syria, but we're not going to get our hands dirty and bomb Syria ourselves. And so even though his message isn't necessarily popular here, that we need to get more, that Germany needs to get more militarily involved, I think people see there, they see somebody taking a principled stand, somebody taking a logical and consistent stand. And I think that's why his discussion has generated so much traction within Germany.
Yeah, he's a fellow who is coming across as a man who's willing to state hard but unpopular but true positions. Yeah, Brent?
I think it's interesting just to consider how popular it would have been for Germany to act amongst Germans had the strikes not been led by Mr. Donald Trump. He is just seen in Germany so much. I think there was a new poll that came out today of how unfavorable he was. More Germans like Putin than they did Trump, and so I would like to see a poll, if it was possible, to see how many Germans actually did agree with Mr. Zu Gutenberg. I think it might be larger than we would naturally think.
Well, with France, go ahead.
Well, I also think that there's an appetite in Germany for a leader that does unpopular things. And what I mean by that, you know, Angela Merkelism has been all about, you know, she's just been shifting to whatever is popular, apart from the massive exception that's immigration.
Yeah.
Her entire chancellorship has been defined by just following whatever the people say. You know, we're for nuclear power. Now there's been the Fukushima disaster. Public opinion's changed. Well, so have I. Now we're against it. We're for this. Now we're against. You know, she's really been blown around on the winds of popular opinion. And I've seen so many columns and articles in Germany talking about, well, we need a leader, not a follower, not someone who will follow popular opinion, somebody who will say unpopular things, but follow their principles. And I think that they're fed up of just a leader that is just blowing in the wind. And I think Brent has a good point, and I think there probably would be much higher popularity if it weren't led by Donald Trump. But I think people would just be impressed by somebody that stays consistent over the course of a decade or more, and that has a clear vision, seems to know where they're going, and isn't blown around kind of the way, you know, there's no kind of sense that Angela Merkel has a vision or any kind of internal consistent logic. And I think her tenure has really opened an appetite in Germany for somebody who just is solid and unyielding in that way.
Another question that I have, Richard, is the outrage within France and the United States and the United Kingdom over say these chemical weapons attacks, that really has been the pretext of the the strikes that these nations took against Syria. This is beyond the pale. This is a red line. We have to do something about this. It seems, though, that there must be larger strategic reasons for why they would actually take the actions that they have. Granted, they were limited. They were surgical. But what is Germany's strategic interest in Syria beyond just if somebody does something bad, we need to punish them?
Well, the big way that these problems intersect is the migrant crisis. And, you know, how do you... Europe's entire political system is being destabilized by the millions of migrants that have been arriving in Europe from Syria. I think you've got then that relates to the much larger problem of terrorism and how how terrorists are coming in from Syria and this breeding ground. And I think that's also perhaps part of the reason why Germany's not getting more involved is, you know, maybe this particular strike is paving the way to more involvement. And I think Brent makes a really good case in his article on the website, "Is France Leading Europe into Syria?" That we're on the path to more European involvement, and this is an important step in that direction. But at the same time, those attacks on Wednesday are going to do on the weekend, sorry, are going to do nothing to solve this migrant crisis. You know, they're too small. And so maybe Germany sets them out because, well, what practical difference would a German plane firing a few missiles have on the migrant crisis? But then taking it kind of more broadly than, say, just Syria, you've also got the question of Iran, and that Syria and Iraq, it marks a major increase in power for Iran. Iran now has this Shia crescent, this access now to the Mediterranean. You've got Iranian terrorists being able to travel from Iran all the way to the Mediterranean, potential of naval bases for Iranian ships. That's something that in the long run, and to people thinking really strategically, that's got to be a huge concern for Europe. It's maybe not as obvious and as in your face or directly related to Syria as the migrant crisis, but if you have such a destabilizing nation as Iran on the shores of the Mediterranean that really is a European lake, that they kind of have this security that's just taken for granted, that you have so much of, say, Europe's oil supplies coming through the Suez Canal, so much of even just its trade traveling through this sea, then you have the potential for Iranian-backed terrorists to threaten that. This is a huge step to the threat to the European economy and to trade. And so you've got to think that people in Europe as well are wondering about the long run. And are thinking, we need to push back against Iran. We need to push back against Iran in general. They're the world's number one sponsor in terror. But also in particular, we need to push back against Iran in the Mediterranean. And so it wouldn't surprise me at all if Zu Gutenberg is thinking along those lines. I think the German defense minister before him lost his job for saying that the German military should be involved to secure supply lines and trade routes. But that's exactly what I think is on their minds. And you look at some of these other German generals and some of the statesmen that they've said. There's one German general, very senior in the German central staff, who talked about Iran creating a ring of fire and talking about Germany having to set up bases and contain that. That's exactly what we're looking at here. And so what you see in terms of what we're watching at the trumpet is an overlap of a couple of different prophecies. And I mentioned there's those prophecies of the strong man in Germany. And that's talked about in Daniel chapter 8, Daniel chapter 11. And these are important prophecies. Don't take my word for what the Bible says here. We have a booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, that you can go and read about that. But Daniel chapter 11 especially, it doesn't just talk about a strong man in Germany. It talks about what this strong man leads Germany and Europe to do. And what it leads Germany and Europe to do, he leads Germany and Europe to do, is confront Iran. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it even talks about how he confronts Iran, and the Bible uses a special key word. It confronts him like a whirlwind. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has an article, Whirlwind Strategy, where he goes through looks at the roots of what that Hebrew word that's translated whirlwind means, and shows how what the Bible is talking about is surrounding Iran. So when you see German generals saying we need to contain Iran and this ring of fire, I mean, that's the whirlwind prophecy on the world scene. Mm-hmm. And then you see this you see this man that we're watching for prophesied in Daniel 11, and he's talking about what is it ultimately confronting Iran in Syria. That's right from these prophecies, you know, just coming to life in world news.
Yeah, this is a really good example of how without that prophetic focus, someone sees an article with a few comments from somebody who has he's on the periphery of German politics, saying that, well, our country should have been involved when we weren't. And just coming to see why that would be something really worth focusing your attention on. You think about the nexus of all of these prophecies that you're talking about. We're watching this man very closely. We're expecting Germany's presence within the Middle East to increase, even Germany's relationship with Syria and its involvement in that that particular country and prying that loose from its alliance with Iran. All of these that we've been watching for quite some time that give this a lot more significance than would meet the eye if you're just looking at the surface. But really, a lot to keep our eyes on, and you just wonder how quickly German military policy would change were someone like Gutenberg to come to power. And it's definitely right at the center of our target as far as what we're watching for in the world. Thank you, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Still more evidence has emerged of just how much China has been propping up the tyrannical nuclear regime of North Korea. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, it was a really interesting week for North Korea, with news breaking yesterday that North and South Korea are apparently possibly close to signing a peace treaty that would finally bring an official end to the Korean War for them. And then North Korea also reportedly said that it's willing to give up its nuclear weapons even if the United States keeps its military presence in South Korea. So if that ends up being true, it would be huge and it would be a very welcome development. But that's a very big if. You know, we've heard some of these kinds of statements before from North Korea, so we really need a hearty dose of skepticism when we hear these kinds of overtures from North Korea. And that skepticism is only compounded when you look at the news that broke this week showing what you mentioned there, which is that two Chinese banks have been laundering money for the North Korean government. These are the Agricultural Bank of China and China Construction Bank. They've both been identified as providing accounts for a sanctioned Chinese trade company that's been helping North Korea to launder its money. So that was according to really a bombshell Bloomberg report from April 14th. And the Obama administration knew about this. It was first discovered back in 2016. But President Obama declined to take any action against these banks, in large part because they're just so massive. These are China's second largest and third largest banks, so they're both bigger than America's largest bank. And President Trump has also declined so far to enforce laws against these banks. I've got a quote here from Jonathan Schanzer of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And he said, quote, "Chinese banks represent the last frontier in Trump's maximum pressure campaign against North Korea. China's financial system is still Pyongyang's financial lifeline, even as the Kim regime finds itself increasingly isolated."
So the United States has obviously been very concerned about North Korea. It seems like more recently, since they've been talking about talks between Kim and Trump, that that the immediate threat seems to have died down, but a lot of very belligerent moves coming from Pyongyang this last year. But really, this shows the much bigger threat is right to North Korea's north.
Yes, that's right. Well, China and also Russia, they're both supporting North Korea. You know, this isn't the only news that we've seen of this. Even just in the last week, a report came out showing that the Chinese government has failed to send North Korean laborers who are working in China to earn money for the Kim regime. China's failed to send them back home. One of the latest rounds of UN sanctions required that North Korean laborers, who are essentially slave laborers for the regime, the sanctions required that they be sent back home. And China signed on to those measures, but they have refused to do that. And this report shows that not only have they failed to send their workers back to North Korea, but they've actually continued to bring even more North Korean laborers in. And then also evidence emerged this week showing that when Kim Jong-un and his wife visited China last month, the president, Xi Jinping, lavished them with about $400,000 worth of luxury items as gifts. So these types of items are specifically banned by sanctions as well. So it's just one more big violation by China. And that last one is really noteworthy because Xi Jinping did that in full view of the United States and the world. There's a quote from Jordan Chang of the Daily Beast. He wrote a powerful piece about this, and he said, quote, "By making the gifts, Xi was telling Washington and everyone else he would do what he wanted." So, you know, it's just clear from all of this that despite what China claims, they remain North Korea's main support.
You have an article on thetrumpet.com about this, the title, "Chinese Banks Are Laundering North Korean Cash," and you draw attention to some statements that Gerald Fleury made about the real threat against the United States, that North Korea is really a puppet in this game that China is playing with the United States.
Yeah, it was really interesting. Even at a time when North Korea was, you know, doing missile tests and nuclear tests, it seemed like about every other week at that time. On September 13th of last year, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury said the world should not be too distracted by that, and that we should be far more concerned about China and Russia, because it is China and Russia who are the ones that are really enabling the Kim regime to behave so belligerently and to threaten other nations with destruction. Mr. Fleury said that his read on that situation is based on Bible prophecy. The exact quote from him said, "The Bible's prophecies show that in a sense, the North Korea crisis is a massive distraction from the real threat posed by China and Russia. These powerful Asian nations are the only reason North Korea is able to operate so freely. And Bible prophecy shows that they pose a threat many times greater than the one from North Korea." End quote. And the prophecies that Mr. Fleury refers to are recorded in Ezekiel 38 and 39, Daniel 11, and throughout the book of Revelation as well. These passages show that in the end time, there will be a huge Asian bloc of nations, but it will not be led by North Korea. It'll be led by Russia. And China will be in kind of a secondary leadership role there. And the scriptures show that less powerful Asian countries like North Korea will lend their military might to that bloc, but they won't be major players in it. And Mr. Fleury has written a very powerful booklet that explains and examines all of these scriptures. It's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And we'll have a link to that in our show notes that will allow listeners to really dive in and understand those.
Well, thanks very much for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about developments in Libya, escalation in the trade war between China and the United States, the rise in anti-Semitism, and an impressive new telescope that could expand our understanding of the universe. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We're going to look now at a development in the North African nation of Libya, a country that has been in disarray ever since strongman Muammar Gaddafi was deposed in 2011. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So this story is more of something to be watching out for in the coming days and weeks. Going back to that time when Gaddafi fell, just before, our editor-in-chief talked about how that there were two nations that were going to form part of the Iranian alliance of the King of the South. And those two nations were Libya and Ethiopia. And we're concerned with Libya right now. He said, as he was writing this article, Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy, he says, you need to watch for Libya and Ethiopia to make a severe and rapid turn into the radical Islamist camp. And so here we are about 7 or 8 years. And the one main reason I would say that that hasn't happened yet is to do with the leadership of one individual, and that is Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar. He's the leader of the Libyan National Army. That's the army that rules over the eastern part of Libya. And he has been extremely effective, the only effective one, at routing Islamists from Libya. Well, this week and back to a week before, I think, there were rumors that he has suffered from a stroke. There were rumors that he died. There's rumors that he's getting treatment right now. He hasn't come out and spoken in 2 weeks. So he's probably got some type of debilitating illness afflicting him. And so the leadership of the Libyan National Army and the one force against Islamists taking over, really, in eastern Libya is perhaps out of the way. And so commentators looking at this right now are worried that it's going to throw Libya into even more chaos. And who's going to rule over the Libyan National Army now? Maybe his sons are going to fight it out. But if I'm an Islamist and this man is leaving, or this man is no longer heading up the army, who was basically had the charismatic leadership to marshal all these forces and bring them together to fight them, I would be excited by this. If I was Qatar, who has been responsible for the strengthening of Islamist groups with the backing of Iran inside Libya, the very people that Haftar has been going after, I would be happy. If I was Egypt's president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, I would be worried because this man has protected my country from the influx of Islamists crossing over the border into Egypt. And so this is just something for people to watch for. Egypt or Libya is going to turn Islamist, as we believe it is, the death of this man could have profound significance towards that goal.
Well, thanks for that, Brent. We will keep our eyes on that situation. And in the meantime, go online to thetrumpet.com and check out that. It's actually a booklet by Gerald Fleury, Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy, demonstrating how these nations they're directly named in the most compelling end-time prophecy regarding Iran and the King of the South. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has drawn attention to just what we can expect in those nations ahead. So we will keep our eyes on that situation. We thank you for drawing our attention to that, Brent. The escalation of trade war between the United States and China continued this week with an announcement out of China. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, on Wednesday, the Chinese Commerce Ministry slapped an import charge of 179% on sorghum coming into China from the U.S. The ministry said that they've investigated America's sorghum and they found it to be unfairly subsidized by the government. In reality, it's a ludicrous assertion, to say that U.S. farmers are dumping sorghum on the Chinese market or anywhere else. But that's what the Chinese claim as justification for this, and it's not an insignificant move. China is the biggest purchaser of U.S. sorghum. They bought almost $1 billion worth of it from America last year. I've been in contact with a farmer in South Texas who grows sorghum and who usually sells almost all of his to China. And he told me this morning that he's now looking for purchasers in Mexico to buy up the excess. So many U.S. farmers are scrambling. And one really interesting aspect of this is that it specifically targets Trump's base. The top 10 states by sorghum production are Kansas, Texas, Arkansas, Nebraska, Colorado, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Missouri, Mississippi, and Louisiana. So all of those except for Colorado are Republican states. So it was really designed to target President Trump's supporters and to kind of punish those who elected him. The Chinese leadership think that this kind of targeting could prompt Trump to maybe back off on some of his demands. And I think there's also hope among the Chinese that targeting his supporters will reduce his chances of being reelected in 2020. So this is really only the latest salvo in the trade dispute that we've seen going on between the U.S. and China. And the Bible talks about a time in the near future when America will be blocked out of global trade by a besiegement. So it really shows that even though right now these are not game-changing maneuvers that are happening, this will lead to what Deuteronomy 28:52 says is basically a blocking out of America, America's ability to trade in global markets. And this is also connected to Isaiah 23 and other Bible passages showing that China will be a lead player on the side that's orchestrating this whole besiegement against America. So Isaiah 23 makes that very clear, and several other passages as well. Our own Richard Palmer has written a powerful article in the last print edition. It's called Spiraling into Trade War. And this article goes in depth into all these scriptures and shows how the current events that we're seeing now are leading to the fulfillment of those scriptures. So we'll be sure to have a link to that in our show notes.
Yeah, go check that out, Spiraling into Trade War. We'll keep our eyes on this situation. It definitely is volatile and continuing to develop. Thanks for bringing us the latest on that, Jeremiah. Yesterday, trumpet writer Brad McDonald wrote a message to our readers about an alarming trend in Europe. This was the subject of his trumpet brief. Trumpet brief is a daily email that we send out to our subscribers. And I just want to encourage you to subscribe to this free service. We have personal messages from our trumpet writers and summaries of a lot of our articles that we have on thetrumpet.com. It is free. You can just go onto thetrumpet.com and subscribe to that. But to hear about this trend that Brad McDonald was writing about, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yeah, this is a trend that I think many people, probably including us, don't talk quite enough about, because it's, you know, there are a few, say, specific news pegs or events of this, but it's just been a huge background story for the last 5, 10, you know, it's something that each year we kind of writing on it getting worse. Mm-hmm. And then one year on, it's just even worse again. And that is the rise of anti-Semitism. So this week, Germany has really especially been talking about this rise of anti-Semitism. There was a video where it was an Israeli Arab, actually, he kind of put on a kippah from a friend to make himself look Jewish and walked around Germany to see what would happen. And he was attacked. Someone was trying to beat him with a whip. There was huge amounts of insults, and he was beaten. And this has provoked a lot of discussion in Germany. It comes at the same time that Israel has its 70th anniversary on that was yesterday. And you go back just the week before, and there were a whole bunch of stats released, this by the European Jewish Congress. They warned that mainstream anti-Semitism in Europe has risen to a level not seen since the Second World War. Their quote showed, well, they just went into a whole bunch of different stats about, you know, attacks on individuals were increasing, 17% rise on attacks on synagogues. It was just over a week ago that a few of us went into London and listened to a talk from the journalist Melanie Phillips on exactly this subject. And, you know, she drew attention to generally what you see as a spike in anti-Semitism when something heats up in Israel. Whereas this latest rise has come where nothing especially big has been going on in Israel. It's just been increasing. Mm-hmm. And so you see this just across the board. It's definitely affecting the UK as well. Increase in anti-Semitism and increase in just the mainstream acceptance of anti-Semitism, even by mainstream left-wing politicians here in the UK. And the point that Mr. McDonald made in this article, and even the point that Melanie Phillips made last week, is that, you know, anti-Semitism is bad often by itself, but it's also a dangerous symptom of a sick society, that it's a symptom of underlying problems. That, you know, Mr. McDonald talked about how you had rising anti-Semitism across Europe, including Britain, including other nations of Europe, in the 1920s and 1930s. It's a symptom of a society in decline. So he talked a bit about that in that article. He went into that in more detail, actually, in an article he had a few years ago, Anti-Semitism, Why You Should Be Alarmed. And so I'm running out of time to discuss it on in this segment, but those two articles, his trumpet brief from yesterday and then this article, Anti-Semitism, Why You Should Be Alarmed, will help you, you know, really see this in its overall context and its big picture. Last Friday, I think, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Mr. Stephen Flurry played some of those clips for Melanie Phillips and talked in a bit more depth about this problem. But it's a symptom of just a dangerous state of the decline of Britain and just the situation in Europe as a whole.
Yeah, and it does, as much as you're making these broader points about just how alarming it is within a nation, anti-Semitism really is at the heart of some of the most significant prophecies that we're watching. When you look at the say whirlwind or the attack of the European empire against Israel, and just how that little nation of Judah is prophesied to fall, as well as certainly the clashes between Israel and the Arabs in that region that are going to cause Jerusalem to explode in a conflagration of violence. It really does factor in very directly in some of these really critical end time prophecies. So go check that out. Brad McDonald's blog. It's on his blog, the bit that he wrote for the Trumpet Brief. Pay attention to rising anti-Semitism in Europe and Britain. We'll include that and the links to these other items in the show notes, including that Trumpet Daily from last week where Stephen Fleury played quotes from Melanie Phillips' address. We appreciate that. Richard, all the political noise taking place in Washington over the Trump scandals, it isn't just arguments happening in office rooms and on cable news channels. It could have a real impact on America's streets. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the police department in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, actually ordered this week that its plainclothes detectives need to bring their uniforms and their riot gear to work starting yesterday and continuing until further notice. And the reason Pittsburgh thinks it's necessary for their police to have their riot gear on them at all times is the progressive activist organization MoveOn.org is getting a petition together to hold up to 800 protests across the nation if Donald Trump fires Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller. This is something that came up earlier in the week after Mueller had given a referral to the a law office in New York to raid the office of Mr. Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. And after that happened, the White House issued an official statement that Trump would be within his constitutional right to fire Robert Mueller. And that is a true statement. Some people have debated it, but the Constitution does give all executive power to the nation's chief executive, the president, so they could fire any member of the executive branch for any reason. But it would probably be unpopular, and it doesn't look like Donald Trump's considering doing that at the moment. But nonetheless, there is this activist group that's gotten 300,000 people to RSVP for up to 800 planned protests should that happen. And apparently police departments, in this case particularly the police department in Pittsburgh, is taking that threat quite seriously. And of course here at thetrumpet.com we keep a close eye on things like this due to biblical prophecies, specifically in the book of Ezekiel, that talk about rioting and race riots in the streets of America and Britain, the nations of end time Israel. In particular, if you request Mr. Gerald Fleury's booklet, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet, chapter 4 of that booklet is on terrorism and race riots, and it goes through in detail passages in Ezekiel 5 explaining a time right before Christ's return when a staggering number of people, approximately 100 million people, one-third of the nation, dies in protest and riots. And so this is talking about like civil war, even almost beyond civil war levels of violence. And there's almost a perfect storm of factors that has to come together to bring that to fruition. But one of the biggest factors is just political violence, political polarization, to where you're seeing now, especially with things like this impeachment campaign against Trump, where he's kind of in between a rock and a hard place, and that no matter whether he fires Mueller or not, or whether he's impeached or not, the divisions in the nation are getting almost to the getting to the point where one side or the other will protest if things don't go in the direction that they want the nation taken in.
Well, thanks for that, Andrew. Go check that out on thetrumpet.com, the Trumpet Hour Hub. We'll have links to these articles, including this one that we have up right now called Protests Planned If President Trump Fires Robert Mueller. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. I want to just squeeze in one last story here with some exciting scientific news. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
So to me, one of the biggest stories of the last few years from space has been the discovery of planets beyond our solar system. You don't have to go that far, and we didn't know about any. People very strongly suspected that there were planets outside the solar system. We'd never been able to see them. But then you had some satellites launched, some studies made, especially the Kepler satellite. And then, you know, boom, we discovered mind-boggling numbers of planets. And the estimates for the number of planets just in our galaxy kind of shot up to, I think it was around, you know, 100 or 200 billion planets. Huge amounts. Now, just this week, NASA launched a brand new satellite that should be better at looking for planets than anything we have had before. Kepler has been the best planet hunter that NASA's had. That found about 2,500 exoplanets, planets beyond our solar system. And this new satellite, TESS, will be looking at an area 380 times larger than the area Kepler looked at. So this should be able to find many, many more planets than Kepler did. And so it may hopefully give us just a better view of what is out there in the galaxy. And of course, this is something that for us at the Trumpet, we're all hugely excited about. The Bible tells us that the universe is man's future. You've got scriptures like Hebrews 1 and Hebrews 2 that talks about, you know, that God is planning to give the universe to mankind. And, you know, we talk about some of these things, you know, like wars in the Middle East and nuclear weapons and protests in the United States. Mankind going out into the universe is ultimately what it is all leading to. You know, this is what God is getting prepared for. This is what all these, that's the plan that all of these events are a part of. So it is really exciting that we might be learning just more about what's out there. This is one of these kind of surreal moments where I find myself plugging one of your own books to you, Mr. Hillicker. But you know, we've got the booklet, Our Awesome Universe Potential, that just, you know, it's a full color booklet with many of these just fantastic pictures that we've had from some of these previous telescopes and missions, going into the details of what man has discovered out there, and then, you know, what the Bible says about our future out there. And you put those together, and it's such a fantastic picture. And so that's a book we're more than happy to send you free of charge. It's my daughter's favorite book that we have, mostly because of the big colorful pictures in there. But it really is an inspiring book. And if, you know, if the news gets you down, that's a great place to go.
That's a marvelous way to finish today's Trumpet Hour. Thanks for that, Richard. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and the literature that we discussed today, including our incredible universe potential. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Jean-Paul Richter. Joys are our wings, sorrows are spurs. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.